Okay, I'm Liz Aronson. That's A-A-R-O-N-S-O-H-N. I was Liz Fusco in 1964, and that's how people down here know me.
Do you spell Fusco?
F-U-S-C-O. It's okay. An Italian name. What I was just talking about is this demonstration that we just saw, that a kid from the community was killed by the, or was shot by the police and was hurt. They said paralyzed. And that's what's happening to our kids. That's one thing that's happening to our kids. Emmett Till was 14, and when I was staying in Sidon, Mississippi in 1965, there was a 14-year-old kid, Freddie Lee Thomas. They mobbed him up on the highway, killed him. No one ever charged for it. No one ever charged for it. They just did it because they could. And then in Hartford, a 14-year-old boy. How old was the young man who was hurt? How old was the young man who was shot?
Hey, Ray.
They didn't shoot him.
They didn't shoot him?
It broke his neck.
In Hartford, it was a 14-year-old boy who was shot in the back by a cop, and we tried to get the cop fired for years. They wouldn't even indict the cop.
Hold him up, let him breathe.
Beg your pardon?
We want to know how we have to go about doing what's right.
Wow. Well, I think that's what the whole meeting inside really needs to talk about. Here it is right now, right? And you're doing what's right. That's probably what should happen. The organizers are in there. Charles McLaren and Hollis Watkins and some other SNCC workers are right in there. And so you might ask for their advice about what they suggest that you might do. Yeah, because that's another outrage.
Yes.
Yeah, another outrage.
And it's time for him to go.
Time for him to go. So,
yes,
ask for Charles McLaren, Hollis Watkins, and they're SNCC workers from the 60s, and they've been working steady ever since. Ask them what they suggest that you might do. And there they are. That's it. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Yeah, Mac just left.
McLaren just left? Is Hollis still in there?
Hollis
Watkins?
Or Lawrence?
Or Guyot. If Guyot is in there, Lawrence Guyot. Yeah, any of them were SNCC workers, and they're experienced with this stuff. They'll know exactly what to suggest to you. But you've got more space now than we had in the 60s to move on the City Hall, to go down with your signs, and to move on City Hall and make these demands.
And there's nothing that they could do to us.
Not by law. No, ma'am. No, ma'am. Not by law. No, my name.
No, that's why we're here.
And the more... Yeah. As long as you're nonviolent, right? Which is... No. So, but it sounds like you did the right thing. You're doing the right thing. This is what needs to happen, is to make that demand and just say, there's no way this can happen.
Right.
Yeah. And it's happening all over the country. It happened in Cincinnati, happened in Florida, happens all the time in L.A. I was just telling this gentleman, happened in Hartford, Connecticut. Cop shot a 14-year-old boy, black boy, in the back, white cop. We tried to get him fired. It took us 2 years. Couldn't get him fired. But we picketed the police station, and we raised our voices. We weren't successful in getting him fired, but he now has a desk job. That's a desk job and a traffic job. So we kept him out of the community, at least, by steady protesting.
Y'all can definitely demand investigation.
They got the FBI stuff up there now. They got state troopers. There's a lot of them up there.
And people are giving testimony about what happened?
Yeah, they had news up there this morning on the news.
Yeah.
The news was up there, and then that's when all the people from the FBI, the state troopers just come from everywhere.
Good. Okay.
And just keep people, go door to door, make sure the whole neighborhood stays.
They told us to get a paper and sign a petition for everybody to put their name on it.
Yep.
The biggest danger is that people, sometimes we get burned out. You know, a march is kind of easy to do, it's spectacular, but then what do you do the next day? You just have to keep people
energized. Go on and
And make phone calls at night and have people go, and because the FBI is from here. right? You know that. So, you know, the FBI agents are all local Mississippians and the state troopers are all local. So, do y'all want to come under the shade of the tree? We'll move out the way. Should we move, Paul?
Yeah, we can move.
Yeah, we'll move our stuff so you can have the shade of the tree. Can I carry something?
I got it.
We can move over to this.
Okay.
Okay. Good luck to you.
All right, thanks.
Mr. Gia.
Organizer, 40 years.
Yeah. They came to the right place. Man. Talk about making it come alive, right? How you doing? Okay.
Why don't I find you a chair?
I don't mind.
You sure?
Yeah, I'm okay. Fine. I just didn't want to be in their way. I wanted them to be able to have the...
Right. Yeah, well, that's exactly how you talk about connecting the past to the present and the future.
Yeah.
I will hear people saying all the time, you know, when I go to events like this or, you know, political organizing that I work with, people say, oh, you know, people today don't have the same passion. It's not true.
It's not true. It's not true at all. And is this on?
Oh, yeah. It's
yeah.
On.
Okay. So I want to say something about Bill Cosby.
Bill Cosby?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was going to say something in my speech, but I wanted to give Hollis much more time. So, but I didn't hear Bill Cosby talk and I didn't see his whole speech written out, but I know the drill. I know what he's talking about. He is blaming the parents and the children in the inner city. He is blaming them for the situation that they're stuck in. And, I mean, talk about a colonized mind, Bill Cosby. I mean, when's the last time he lived in the inner city? Does he forget his roots? He forgets that this is, that most of the people in the inner city are being raised by single parents who have to work 2-3 jobs and they're not home. And that those, they have to work all those jobs because there are not the jobs there used to be for people. And the drugs that are in the city, people are dealing because there are no jobs. They've got to be able to pay the rent and put food on the table. They're doing that to help out their mamas. It is not because they choose it. And the mamas, for the most part, are not any more crackheads than the wealthy white people in the suburbs are into cocaine and are doing whatever they're doing. It's not disproportionately a thing of black families. And it isn't that the black families don't cherish their children, they love their children. But I will say to you that most of the young people that I work with who are going to be teachers in a few semesters are convinced that black parents don't care about their kids. Poor parents don't care about their kids. If they did, they would come to conferences. And my graduate students all say this. Well, you know, they didn't come for a conference, right? I had only 3 parents show up. That's because black parents don't care, poor parents. And I said, well, come on, what are you talking about? And I try to have them understand, be in the position of a person who has to work 2 or 3 jobs. Right, and I finally say to them, look, parent involvement, what do you mean by parent involvement? Well, like my mother did. Well, your mother was able to stay home because your father worked a job that provided for everybody in the family. One person could provide for everybody. Your mother was able to be a room mother. But not everybody's able to do that, right? And so that shouldn't be the model. I said, is it parent involvement that that child gets to school every day? And they had to admit, yeah, it's clear that no matter what, if that child gets to school every day, that parent cares about that child's education. And that's all the involvement you need. Anything on top of that is extra. But it means teachers have to take the initiative to show parents that we care about their children. We have to assume parents care about their children, but Cosby has done a terrible disservice, I think, by himself putting down the black family in the inner city, right? And not only does he talk about that they don't watch their children, they don't care about their children, he's talking about their language. That's Ebonics. That's the language that slaves developed out of African grammars with English, the master's vocabulary, on top of it. It's an incredible incredibly creative language that was developed that is now spoken across this country. It is not slang. It has a very predictable grammar and syntax and style. It is its own language. And for Cosby not to recognize that, he has bought into all the white middle class myths. And it's tragic to hear him talking about this stuff. And the best antidote to it, I think, is Boondocks.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Aaron
Magruder.
Yeah.
I'm so glad that Aaron Magruder has taken on Cosby.
Yeah.
Because that's what he's talking about. I mean, he's white folks love hearing this.
Oh, yeah.
Because they love to bash the black family.
Right. The irony about what Cosby said, there's so many ironies, but one of them is that the behavior that he's attacking is one of the things that's been commodified and is primarily consumed in
yes.
the white middle class
oh,
community.
Oh, yes, yes.
The talk, the lingo, the hip-hop, the pants. I mean, I see it with my, even, you know, my university students, white students, who do everything they can to try to, as they think, act black.
Yeah, because it's cool.
Because it's cool, and it's been commodified, MTV. And,
yeah.
And so it's ironic, I think, that Cosby, who's like the consummate entrepreneur,
yeah.
either doesn't understand this, you know.
Or has been paid not to understand
yeah, paid,
it. But I think he's just been gone so long. And I think that's why it's so interesting that those of us who are here, who are still working, which is most people who were really part of the movement, know that's not true. But Cosby never was. He grew up middle class. He's got his doctorate from the same place I've got my doctorate from. And so I challenge my colleague, Bill Cosby. Having a doctorate doesn't make you smart.
No.
Right? Being president doesn't mean you're smart.
Nope.
Right? Ms. Hamer was smarter than any of them. She had an 8th grade education. She spoke Ebonics. These people in here speak Ebonics. They're not ignorant. They're not lazy. They're not refusing to work hard. They're not rejecting America. You listen to Ray Charles sing America the Beautiful.
Yeah.
That's not rejecting America, but he's speaking Ebonics.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah. He sings. He sang in his own way, and yeah, exactly. Liz, I wonder if we could talk about the experience that you had in the civil rights movement, and if you could talk about what led you into the movement. I mean, childhood experiences, your younger life growing up.
Okay, I've written about that, and there's a book called Owning and Disowning White. Edited by trying to remember the names of the people. It's from your part of the country. They were at Jim O'Donnell at University of Arizona in
oh, okay. I could find it from the title.
Yeah. Owning and Disowning White. What are the universities? There's one at Portales. That's Eastern New Mexico State. What's the other one?
There's UNM, University of New Mexico, Eastern New Mexico State.
What's the name of the towns where they are? Do you know? Anyway, one of those towns.
Okay.
It's got a C name, a short name, one...
Okay.
Whatever it is. Anyway, Jim O'Donnell and his colleague who has left New Mexico, but anyway, he's one of the editors. Owning and Disowning White, and it's the whole idea of whiteness and how white people came about their commitment and all of that stuff is really a topic of conversation. We've talked about it at National Association of Multicultural Educators for the past several years, and several books are out like ours. But basically, I will say this to you. My father was a rabbi, and he taught me justice, justice shalt thou do.
Mm-hmm.
And I took him seriously. Period.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
And then when you were, when you came, I mean, what was the start of your involvement with the movement?
Well, let's see. you're talking about SNCC and CORE and Mississippi,
yeah.
Or are you talking about civil rights in general?
what about civil rights in general?
Yeah, well, I can go back. I suppose when I was in Seattle, Washington, I had planned to go to the Peace Corps, but I was selected out because I was asking too many questions about Vietnam and about class structure in the United States. They said, you'll have servants in Ethiopia as teachers. Teachers have servants. And I said, uh-uh, I'm not going to have any servants. I don't believe in having servants. My mother grew up in an orphanage, and she was a servant, and I won't have servants. I was arrogant 23, 24-year-old, and so they selected me out. They said, maybe it's the way you wear your hair. I had big hair, and I played guitar, and I walked around barefoot. It was 1962. So I started to question America at that time, and that's, I guess, I was living in Seattle, so I joined Seattle Corps, and we were doing sit-ins and demonstrations just like this for the same reasons. So I was active in Seattle, and then I read in a paper called The National Guardian, no longer exists, about a call for white volunteers, northern volunteers, to come down. And I was wanting to leave a bad marriage, and so I said, okay. And I got so hooked in Oxford, Ohio, and being here in Louisville, and I just stayed, stayed for 2 years. And I left at the end of 2 years because I really wanted to be teaching, and mostly by the end I was going out canvassing, encouraging people to register to vote one-on-one. I missed the classroom because I had been a teacher before. I was older than most of the young people who came down. I'd already, I was 28 when I came down. I was already teaching 3 or 4 years. So the white power structure would not let me teach. There weren't any integrated schools, and they wouldn't let me teach in either the black or the white schools, so I left. And I, that's when I went up to New York City, and got involved with Teachers Against Racism. But I think everything in my life led me to that, or got in the way of that, one or the other.
Now, today in your discussion, in the panel discussion, you were talking about the importance of the Freedom Schools, and this is something that historians and everyone else is finally realizing was part of the movement,
because for many years
when you hear about the movement, even now, I mean, let's be honest, even now when you hear about the civil rights movement, the freedom schools are always the last thing that's brought in.
It's an, oh, by the way, there were also freedom schools, yeah, but as Hollis was saying today, and I strongly feel, and as Dr. Vincent Harding talks about in here, it's the liberation of people's minds from a slave mentality and a mentality of inferiority. That if you, who was he quoting where he said, if you convince people they're inferior, you don't have to do any more work. They've already enslaved themselves. So bringing black history to people, bringing their voices back to them. We had a newspaper called The Student Voice. And the whole idea of voice was really, really important. So that, I think, what most of us discovered, even though there were separate projects, the voter registration project, voter registration, community centers, and Freedom School. And then we realized before the end of the summer that it was really one, one project, that you couldn't have voter registration without Freedom School, and you couldn't have a place for all of this without a community center, and who you were teaching, if we're going to put that in quotation marks, who you're teaching are not just teenagers that you thought you were going to be teaching lessons to, but it's everybody. It's elderly people who want to learn. It's Paulo Freire's idea.
But we didn't
know about Paulo Freire at that time, although he was operating in Brazil at the same time as we were operating in Mississippi. But we didn't know about that then. Only later did we find that out.
Liz, can you talk about the, in your talk today, you talked about the emphasis being on freedom school, not school freedom. Can you talk about the interactions between the teachers and the students in the inside of the Freedom School? What made it different than a conventional education?
Because, as Freire talks about, it was a dialogue. It was not in any way traditional lecture discussion kind of thing, but it was us learning at its best. It was us learning from students, students learning from teacher, and teacher learning from students. And it was, and the content and the process were both focused. Sorry, I hope that doesn't.
No, that's fine.
Yeah. The content was definitely about rights and about history and about claiming. Michelle Cliff calls it claiming an identity they taught me to despise. And it's claiming your own identity in very powerful ways. And that's freedom, right? It's the liberation of the mind. It's people's, what I talked about in some of the poetry I wrote was scratching the scales off your eyes and being able to see clearly. And sometimes it was one-on-one, and sometimes it was having kids talk to each other, and sometimes it was whatever came up. There was, the structure was not what most teachers who came down from the North expected the structure to be, and some, probably myself at first, we were very, there was an uncertainty, as there always is in teaching,
right.
Uncertainty, but there was a special uncertainty here because we thought we knew what school was and what teaching was, but we thought we knew what learning was. I mean, I had a master's degree, high-powered education, Smith and Yale. No wonder I was so arrogant, you know, and came down and I started listening to local people. And it took me 2 years to learn what I needed to learn. But the Freedom Schools, as we conducted them, were different depending on the constituency, depending on who showed up, depending on who was there, in every place across the whole state. And there was a Freedom School convention, I recall, in 64 and probably another one in 65. But I'm not so sure about the history of all of that. I do know that when I became coordinator of the Freedom Schools, when Stott and Lind went back to Yale, he asked Ralph Featherstone and me to be coordinators, and my job was just to go around the state and provide materials for people. What did I know, right? So I was just driving around the state giving support.
I wonder, Liz, if you could talk about, it seems to me that a very striking thing that you were saying is that when you came here, you had a master's degree, you had all the credentials that would qualify you to be at the head of the classroom.
Yep.
But then when you came here, you started learning from your students. Now, that's something that's very, it's almost alien, and almost an alien idea in the American educational system. Could you talk about that process of being a person who felt very much like you knew what the students needed, and then what allowed you to begin to learn from them, and then what did you learn from them?
Well, as I say, it took me 2 years. It took me the whole 2 years, and I know I stepped on a lot of toes in that time, especially at the beginning. And it wasn't just my project directors and project members, though I know I did that too. But it was probably local people, and I probably, caused some pain. I think, I can't say, Paul, exactly, I can't pinpoint what allowed me to do that. I guess, as I reflected, which is why now as I teach teachers, I work so hard on having them reflect on their experiences. Dewey says it's that education comes from experience, but not just the experience itself, it's the reflection upon experience. And so it was being able to reflect and write about it that allowed me to just step back and not have to be in charge. And that was the whole idea. It was Charlie Cobb's idea from the beginning of the Freedom Schools, but all of us white teachers, and maybe some of the black teachers from the North too, we had one model in our minds, right, of what teaching is. So I think we had to, those of us who stayed long enough, those who got frustrated with it left, and those of us who said, wait a second, there's something here I can learn. Because we began to respect the people we were working with so deeply, and we were so dependent on them for our safety, for our lives, for our food, for the reason for our existence.
Mm-hmm. Where you gonna go?
I think there was also a spiritual content to that. The mass meetings and the church services, all of us who were white and had not been raised in the Black Baptist Church began to see, there's a depth of knowledge here that we don't know anything about, we've never been taught anything about. And also, we began to learn along with our students. I remember even in Ruleville, and certainly in Indianola and Sidon, the book that I was using mostly was Pictorial History of the Negro in America, Milton Metzger, and I think Langston Hughes was part of that before he died. Uh-huh. I can't remember. It was published in 60-something, but I don't know why I think Langston Hughes had anything to do with that, but...
Uh-huh.
But anyway, Pictorial History of the Negro in America. We started to learn a content that had never been part of our schooling. And so we began to question our own schooling about content, as well as about process, as well as about purpose. All of that stuff. And I think once I questioned my upper class education, I was not upper class myself. I was a quota student being a Jew at Smith. There was a ceiling. And my father, having been blinded in World War I, we lived on a government pension, so we didn't have money, but I got in on scholarship there. So I always knew I was marginalized for that reason. I think that's what helped me, too, to side with those who are on the margins rather than to see from the center.
Because you'd experienced it.
In many ways. As a Jew, as a person of very little money, I could see that. So I think that helped me be predisposed to standing at the margins of society and looking at society, not from the inside, not from where Eastland sits, but... the critic.
Is there anything else that you want to add that we haven't talked about in terms of what you think, and also, if I could kind of interject, what has the experience been like coming back here after 4 years?
Well, it started in January when Stacy called me. January, February, December, I can't remember what, I got a call at school, and she said, Liz Aronson, were you Liz Fusco in Indianola? And my heart stopped, because no one knew me in my new life in that way, but it was such a pivotal experience for me. So ever since that moment, talking to Stacy on the phone, I was very excited to come back. And then I started thinking about all the toes I had stepped on. And I called Stacy and I said, you know what, Stacy, I'm reluctant to come because if a couple of people are coming whom I really know I gave pain to, I don't want them to have to suffer my presence. And she said to me something that I knew in my head from Nelson Mandela, but I hadn't put together in terms of me. She said, and you've been carrying that burden for 40 years. She said, we're a forgiving people. She said, if those people are here, they will forgive you. Mm-hmm. And you come on down. So I just felt so welcomed. But it's been a pilgrimage, to tell you the truth, and it was especially a pilgrimage I felt I had to take. A side pilgrimage to the town of Sidon, which is 10 miles south of Greenwood, where I stayed from 65 to 66, where I worked I was the only outside agitator there, and I felt like I had to make that pilgrimage and go there and just visit and be there and see whoever. And to see the place unchanged since I left it. Took me back, and also has made me reflect in lots of ways. It's why I mentioned it. To know that Noel is dead now because of what happened in Vietnam. He joined the army because there wasn't any jobs. And he went to Vietnam and he came back, but he was not a whole person. And I saw his mama. I went and visited her in Rising Sun. I called her and asked, could I visit? She looked the same, gray, but just the same after 40 years. And she told me when he came back from Vietnam, he was never right, and he lasted 20 years. And he was kind of a beautiful, strapping young man, 18 years old. Joined the army because what else can one do? Which is the same reason people deal drugs. What are you going to do? You got to live. There aren't any options. And I think the system sets it up that way. So this has re-energized me to talk to my students more, help them understand how the system works to keep black people down, keep structures the way they are, for systems of advantage for certain people. So I'd been getting kind of tired at my age of teaching full-time, 12 credits, 12 credits each semester, and saying to myself, well, you know, maybe someone else can carry it on, but this has given me a few more years at least to keep going, because I know it needs to happen.
Well, thanks so much, Liz, for taking time out of your schedule.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you listening.
Stacy's going to, basically what I'm going to do with the tapes is I'm going to make copies of when I get back to Santa Cruz, I'll make copies.